Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Nick Saicheney. I'm Senior Fellow and Deputy Director of the Japan Chair here at CSIS. And on behalf of Dr. Hamry, who unfortunately couldn't make it today, and my CSIS colleagues, it's my pleasure to welcome you this afternoon. Delighted to see you all here. We're also webcasting this event at csis.org, and I'd like to welcome our online audience. And for your Twitter fans, we're also tweeting at CSIS, hashtag CSISLive. So this survey project is a sequel to a survey we conducted in 2008-2009 on Asia's emerging power relations, institutions, and norms. That original survey, as well as the one we're discussing today, is on our website. But very briefly, I just thought I'd go through a few of the core findings from our original effort, because I think you'll hear those themes over the course of our discussion today. The first core finding in our original survey was that there was notional support for the creation of a so-called East Asia community, but that there was also skepticism about the ability of regional institutions to handle security, economic, or transnational crises. Second core theme was that we found a strong degree of support for the idea that an East Asia community should be based on democratic norms, such as human rights, free and fair elections, and good governance. But there were divisions also about whether states should cede national sovereignty to advance those norms. And in response to questions about regional dynamics, there was a clear assessment that power was shifting to China, but trust was highest toward the United States, with the exception of Thailand, where mistrust of the US was significant. Needless to say, much has transpired in the region since then, and our team here at CSIS decided it would be good to do a follow-up survey to reassess these trends in the region. And our panel of CSIS scholars here will share some of the results and their analysis in a moment. But very briefly, I just want to make a few comments about the methodology up front. Like our previous effort, this survey was aimed at strategic elites, which we defined as non-governmental experts who are influential in the debate on international and/or Asian regional affairs. Excluded were serving members of the legislative, judicial, or administrative branches of government, and those whose expertise lies outside of international relations or Asia. This time around, our team identified candidates in Australia, Burma, Myanmar, China, India, Indonesia, Japan, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, and the United States. And we made a very conscious effort to get a balanced range in all of those, and to get a sense of strategic views across the region. In collaboration with Opinion Dynamics Corporation, we then developed an online survey template, and this survey was fielded electronically between March 24th and April 22nd of this year. out of approximately 1,500 candidates, we generated 402 responses, which was a response rate of about 27%. And that response rate is broken down on page 5 of our report. I want to note, though, that to allow comparisons across a range of national responses that varied from 23 to 81, we used average values that weight each country equally. Burma, Myanmar was excluded due to a low response rate, but you'll see that we analyzed that separately in a section at the end of our report. Very quickly, just wanted to note that there are some advantages and limitations to this kind of survey sample. You know, this is a good cross-section of strategic views on power and order in Asia, but the selection of strategic elites is necessarily subjective, and the sample does not necessarily reflect the full range of elite views in the region. So this type of survey cannot be compared to larger public opinion polls in terms of precision or margin of error. Nonetheless, we're confident that it'll enhance understanding of the strategic landscape in Asia, with respect to power, norms, and regional institutions. Finally, just a few quick words of thanks. First, we'd like to thank the MacArthur Foundation for supporting this research. I'd like to acknowledge Ernie Pikopoulos, principal at Opinion Dynamics Corporation, for his expert advice and collaboration on this effort. Our media partners, Asahi Shimbun, China Times, and Jungang Ilbo, for their support and assistance in disseminating the results and our survey analysis. Our project director, Dr. Michael Green, as well as our team of Asia scholars. I'd like to thank Will Coulson and Zach Cooper, who really put in a lot of time and effort on this report, as well as a number of staff in the CSIS Asia programs, external relations, and the publications department who helped us design and implement this survey. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Dr. Green. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. And Nick really honchoed this effort with our media partners and with Opinion Dynamics and our partner Ernie Pikopoulos and within CSIS. So thank you, Nick. We're going to go through the major findings that we drew from the survey. And I'm going to give you nine of them and one or two or three graphs for each. And then for each finding, I'll ask a colleague or two or three to weigh in on their view of what we're seeing. And then we want to leave time for discussion with the audience, questions, but also comment or insights. This is a survey, in effect, of all of our counterparts in the region, not all of them, a significant number of our counterparts in the region. We tried very hard to have a balanced pool. We did the surveys in Thai, Japanese, Korean, Chinese, and so forth. But as Nick said, this is not a public opinion poll with a scientific margin of error. This is a snapshot or an impression. Some of the results were surprising to us. Some of them confirmed what we're all hearing in the region. But it's really the starting point for a discussion of the dynamics in Asia and especially how strategic elites, people thinking about the region, expect order, power, trade, values to look over the next decade. And so it's a starting point, and your comments to us today are frankly as important as what we found in the survey. We want to use this to generate discussion and debate. So please don't come away with the idea that we have a scientific conclusion, game over, you know, the U.S. will lead forever in Asia or something like that. So let me start going through the findings. Will Coulson's going to put them up, and we can come back to them later during the discussion if you wanted to ask about a specific survey or share an insight on what might explain the result. You should all have a binder in front of you with the report. This is the not quite as fancy version we got for today. We'll have a slightly same content, slightly fancier cover in a week or two, and it's on our website as well. The first finding, consistent with our survey 4 years ago, was that experts in the region expect power to shift over the next decade to China. Next slide, Will. So this is in your packet as well, but as you can see, on balance, the view across the region when we averaged or weighted for each country was that that China would exert the most power in Asia in 10 years. There were at least two really interesting responses, though. If you look on the left, you'll see that those who disagreed with this notion were primarily Chinese and American experts. 71% of the Chinese respondents said that the U.S., in fact, would exert the greatest power in East Asia in a decade, and a similar number, 68% of the Americans agreed. U.S. allies, Japan, Korea, Australia tended to be that way, and then other countries we surveyed expected more of a power shift to Asia. So I'm going to come to our experts in a second, but that result is not completely surprising, the sense that power is shifting to Asia, but the Chinese response and perhaps the American response were a bit unexpected. Next slide. We asked a number of questions about China's impact on the region, and found, on average, 79% of respondents thought that China would exert a very positive or positive impact economically, but 61% across the region expected that China would exert a bad or very bad influence on the security developments. The blue column shows the expectations for those who said China would have a very positive or somewhat positive impact on economics. The red security, you'll note that only one country did a majority of respondents say China will have a good impact on regional security. That was China, 83% of the experts. Across the rest of the region, much lower, particularly low in the US and Japan. And then the third one for this particular grouping of findings, next slide. Yes, thanks, Will, that's it. Which of the following countries do you think will be your country's most important economic partner in 10 years? And this obviously is part of the explanation for those countries that found China would exert the most influence. Leading the list, Taiwan. Followed noticeably by Korea and Australia. If you look to the right of this chart, you'll see the outliers. Japan and Japanese experts, 71% said that the United States in 10 years would be Japan's most important economic partner. My first reaction to this was that it was wishful thinking in Japanese think tanks, nervous about China. But as I talked, I was in Japan this last week, as I talked to CEOs and economic planners, I think sometimes in the U.S. we miss how much Japanese companies are interested in American shale gas, infrastructure, energy. So I think this, in my view, and Matt and others may want to weigh in, this actually may be not just wishful thinking, but a fairly accurate perception of where the U.S.-Japan economic relationship might be in 10 years. But the particularly striking one was China, where 83% of Chinese experts said, not surprising when you think about it, but 83% of Chinese experts said the U.S. would be their most economically important partner. And this included Canada, the EU, and others. To me, that's quite striking. It suggests that there's a lot more recognition in Beijing among elites of how important the U.S. is than perhaps there is in other parts of Asia, that other parts of Asia may not appreciate how much the U.S. and China economically have of a stake in each other, and particularly how much Chinese experts view their stake in economic relations with the U.S. So for some commentary from colleagues on this first set of findings, let me ask Chris and Rick and Victor. Chris is our Freeman Chair on China Studies. Rick is our Wadhwani Chair on U.S.-India. And Victor is our Korea Chair. And let's start with you, Chris.
I suppose the first thing to point out is in the first slide, where obviously you have this large number of Chinese respondents that is suggesting that the U.S. will exert the greatest power. I personally didn't find this to be a terribly shocking response, but I think it does highlight a couple of things. The first is that I think it's emblematic of what we're seeing if you look at the arc from the global financial crisis and now moving forward, as we kind of get back toward a more steady equilibrium in U.S.-China perceptions of themselves and each other. I think after the global financial crisis, there was a very strong perception in China that they had found some third way and that their rise was inevitable and the U.S. was in either, you know, seriously had stumbled or was already in permanent decline. I think those assessments have started to even out as the U.S. has done better economically, as the shale oil and gas revolution takes place. And most importantly, I think affecting these numbers are deepening concerns inside the Chinese system about their own ability to maintain the robust economic growth that they've been witnessing over the last several years, especially as the reform process that they're going through now is really beginning to bite, and you're getting a much more solid understanding, I think, across Chinese elites that that's going to be a very difficult process, and there'll be some bumps in the road. I think the second reason why we see that number, again, is tells us the story to some degree of this debate within China about what kind of China does China want to be, and how are they going to comport themselves on the international stage, and so on. And so that number reflects to me that still this sense of we're still sorting that out, so the U.S., you know, will continue to play the same role that it has been in terms of leading. And then I think most importantly, that slide also really gives the lie, if you will, to this notion that all Chinese are just brimming with hubris and assertiveness and aggressiveness. Clearly that isn't reflected here. And then on the second slide, I just wanted to make a comment. Will, can you move to the second one? So the numbers I take from this one, I think, is quite interesting, is that for Sino-U.S. relations, the implications here are we need to focus on the economic pieces of the relationship, not the security stuff, right? And we're going through this right now with cyber and everything else that we've witnessed here in the last couple weeks. I was just in Beijing, and when I came, conversations I had there, is abundantly clear to me that too much emphasis on trying to solve very difficult, intractable security problems, when in fact they should probably be being managed, and not enough emphasis on trying to look at the economic pieces of the bilateral relationship, where in fact there may be some solutions.
Well, from the India perspective, I mean, you see that India looks at China's rise as the regional power, and they see that as the most likely scenario at among the highest levels across all of Asia, and they do have concerns about what that means for the region. At the same time, they're one of only two countries in the region, Japan being the other, that view that the United States will be their strongest economic partner in 10 years. So I presume that the new Prime Minister in India, Mr. Narendra Modi, has probably seen this data that we prepared, and that is painting his administration's outlook in foreign affairs so far, because you look at the steps that he's taken. I mean, there was a lot of hair pulling. You can see that I was active in that before, on whether or not the denial of the revocation of Mr. Modi's visa 10 years ago would paint his perceptions about the United States, whether we would have a warm welcome when he was if and when he was elected. And indeed, you know, actually, I think that the steps for outreach that the U.S. has taken so far have been reciprocated as warmly as can be expected. In fact, you know, there's rumors going on right now. I don't know if the other side has confirmed it, that he may actually come to Washington later this year. So I think he looks at this same things that the experts in India picked up here. China's going to be the big power. They're concerned about that rise, and the United States will be their top economic partner. And Modi's not going to want to wait for that future. He's a pragmatic guy, and the day that he's in office, if that's what he thinks the future is going to look like, let's start rushing towards that right now. So I think so far, I think this kind of this sort of sentiments are painting what he's been doing so far.
Well, if you can go to the third slide. Is that the third slide? Yeah, okay. From the Korean perspective, you look at this, I mean, to me what's so interesting is you see Korea there at 86%, seeing China as the most important economic partner, and then just way on the other side of the graph is Japan, that has almost a completely the reverse view of their economic future partner. And I think for Korea, Korea is very schizophrenic, or perhaps even bipolar, when it comes to China. And I think the set of charts really do show that, because on the one hand, they acknowledge the objective reality that China is their most important economic partner. But then on figure two, if you look as to the question of whether they like the fact that China is their most important economic partner, whether China has a positive impact, their numbers are pretty high there, but they're still lower than the United States, Australia, Singapore, Thailand. In fact, even lower than China. So again, that just shows to me that the Koreans, on the one hand, there's this objective reality that they acknowledge China is their key economic partner, but whether they're entirely happy about that is not at all clear. Furthermore, not to step ahead, Mike, but in the next set of charts that you're going to be showing, you'll see when it comes to the question of how Korea feels about U.S. leadership, in the future, they're way off the charts in terms of positive support. So, you know, it's a very sort of conflicted and schizophrenic view.
Thanks. So the second finding we broadly took away was, in spite of this perception of a shift in relative power towards China, there are strong expectations among regional experts we surveyed that on a regional basis, U.S. leadership will remain strong. And in this next slide, you'll see we asked the expectations of these experts over the next decade, and we gave them five different scenarios. Continued U.S. leadership, even if relative U.S. power declines. An uneasy balance of power among the major regional states, but with no one state dominant. The yellow bar is a new community of nations based on strengthened multilateral institutions and cooperation. The red bar is Chinese primacy, and then the bottom bar, I think that's gold, is a U.S.-China condominium. You hear a lot of talk about all these scenarios in the region. I'm sure you have. You've read about them. But when we asked our experts in the region to choose, the strongest answer was that the first one, that there would be continued U.S. leadership. And as Victor noted, especially in Korea, generally among U.S. allies, in China, whereas Thailand, Indonesia, less certainty about that. Then we asked which of these five scenarios would be in the best interests of your country in the next 10 years. You know, Japan, no doubt about it, U.S. leadership. Japanese are even more sure of that than Americans are. And then the U.S. allies and partners. It's interesting that India, China, to a lesser extent, Indonesia, Thailand, in other words, especially South and Southeast Asia, had a preference for a community of nations based on multilateral cooperation. There was not a lot of appetite for a balance of power among the major states, presumably India, Australia, Korea, Japan. Not much appetite for that, very little appetite for Sino-centric system, and almost no appetite for a U.S.-China condominium. Most respondents had strong preferences, and one thing that jumped out here was that in China, there was quite a diffuse mix. Clearly, not a lot of enthusiasm for U.S. leadership, but not a strong preference or consensus among the Chinese experts about what sort of regional order they'd prefer instead. So let me ask for comment on that to Bonnie and Ernie.
Well, on the first slide, I think that there is recognition in China, as Chris was saying earlier, of persisting U.S. lead, particularly in comprehensive national power. The Chinese, especially the strategic elites that we surveyed, I think don't share this public opinion in China that when China overtakes the United States in aggregate GDP, that will necessarily mean that China's power is going to be greater overall than the United States. So I think that's one point. Secondly, I think that the Chinese are really not ready to take on leadership themselves. It's widely seen in China that getting too entangled abroad, getting distracted from their major task of increasing their own economic power domestically, that this is not necessarily in Chinese interest. At the same time, it's quite clear that they are uncomfortable, if you go to the next slide, with the notion of U.S. leadership. So you do see relatively small numbers of Chinese that support continued U.S. leadership. Another comment that I would make is, yes, there's quite diffuse views in China as to what kind of power they would like to see in Asia. Community of nations is certainly among, I think, scholars, think tank experts, is the preference. But note that there is greater support, more than 20%, for a U.S.-China condominium than in any other country. And I think that this is the way a new type of major power relationship is, in fact, viewed in China. This is Xi Jinping's notion that he has put forward. It's not quite explicitly referenced as a G2 arrangement, but I do think it reflects China's preference for being treated as an equal with the United States and sharing power.
For Southeast Asia, what we can see here is the Southeast Asians understand balance and consensus. That's their priority. And we take the findings in these slides with the earlier slides. What there's a clear message for U.S. strategy here, if we did have one, and that would be that economics in Asia is security. I would really underline that point. For the Southeast Asians, they cannot imagine a regional economic framework that doesn't include China. And they can't imagine a regional security framework that doesn't include the United States. They want both of us included. I think the things that could change these lines of trajectory would be a U.S. failure to move forward with a comprehensive economic strategy for Asia. That's TPP and beyond. TPP would not be sufficient, in my view, and or a Chinese failure on the security side. Southeast Asia is responding very negatively to increased Chinese aggression on the South China Sea and up north, and there's a lot of concern about that. So what we're seeing here is a strong indicator, a strong pull from the Southeast Asians, and a comfort level with regional frameworks being built to manage these relationships. Notable, a Malaysian diplomat once told me that the genius of ASEAN was that it took Indonesia, which was in the 60s the big boy in the neighborhood who no one really understood. They didn't know what the Indonesians wanted or what the Indonesians wanted to be. And they created a framework, ASEAN, in which the Indonesians could have a lot of face, a lot of room to be the BAPOK or the big player. And then eventually co-opt the Indonesians into making the rules and playing by the rules in the neighborhood. And that is exactly what the answer the Southeast Asians want to use to manage China's emergence on the regional and global stage.
Thanks. The third broad finding we had was that there is a broad support for the U.S. rebalance, also known as the pivot, but concern about implementation. The next chart, we show this both in a bar graph and in a heat map of the region. Green is enthusiastic, red is opposed. So this looks a little bit like, I think, some of our Chinese friends' image of containment strategy, but that's not what it's intended to show. What it shows is the view of the rebalance, 79% on average across the region, but only 23% of the Chinese respondents had a positive view. But China's really an outlier. Every other country, there was strong support for the rebalance. In the US, 96%. So CSIS scholars were not allowed to answer the survey, but we tried very hard to have a balance across town. So I don't know who, but this means our friends at Heritage or AEI, who have not always been as charitable to the administration, I would say broadly support the rebalance. So this, to me, should be a sign to our friends in the region that this has bipartisan legs, and that with maybe one or two exceptions we won't say on the record, pretty much any candidate going into 2016 is going to keep doing this. Various polls, not ours, but public opinion polls show that now consistently a majority of Americans say Asia is the most important region in the world to us. So the 96% support for the US, I think, is actually maybe the most surprising part of this, and it's good, because a lot of us up here feel that the rebalance should continue. Now, when we asked about how it's going, or how would you characterize the rebalance on the next slide, it's a little more mixed result for the administration. We broke these into the four answers. And what you find is that in the upper left, one characterization was, would you describe the rebalance as too confrontational towards China? Nobody took that bait. Almost no country responded that way, except in China, where there was a very strong response that the rebalance is too confrontational to China. But that was only in China. And I think it's important to recognize that over half of the respondents' view was there just needs to be more of it, insufficient resources and implementation. We could go round and round about why that is. It's particularly strongly felt among US allies. Matt pointed out earlier among TPP partners. So part of it is probably a lack of satisfaction at progress on TPP in this town. I suspect part of it is concern about the defense budget here. You don't have to read too far into the Japanese, Korean, or Australian media to see that there's concern about Syria and what that meant, and frankly, whether the second term of President Obama has people who are as committed as the first term. Some of this is impressionistic. But the bottom line is the entire region wants us to do this, thinks it's important, but we have a problem in China. So let me ask for some comments. Actually, why don't we move on to that? So I just want to ask Rick to comment on the India part, because India's response to the rebalance is interesting.
Yeah, well, I think 10 years ago, we didn't have a term for it. We didn't call it the pivot back then. But I think, you know, those of us that are so buried in just US-India only saw about 10 years ago a real pivot towards India. We didn't call it that same thing at the time, but it really was. And, you know, for a variety of reasons, but most importantly because of how India handled the liability law, for civilian nuclear liability, a little bit of interest was lost. And so those of us that are stuck in the U.S.-India vein look at the rebalance towards Asia as though a little bit less attention in the region on India. And so, again, for the U.S.-India folks, the rebalance in some ways, you know, gives India a little bit less attention. But interestingly, that India had actually above higher support. People in India had above higher support for the rebalance because for them, it's not just about having a love fest with the United States. It's about their own regional security. And they're more concerned, as we show in our data as well, on there actually being, you know, hot warfare potentially because of regional issues, because of border issues. So for them, it's not about a one-on-one relationship or anything like that, but anything that puts more attention on the region there and creates a more stable environment, India is very supportive of.
Our fourth broad finding was that experts in the region clearly view territorial confrontations as the major obstacle to regional community building. And as Nick noted, we did the survey in 2009 with the support of MacArthur Foundation. They also were very supportive and both in content and budget for this effort as well. In 2009, we asked a lot of questions about institutions. And then we asked questions we call the Ghostbuster questions. Who are you going to call? So if there's a financial crisis, a pandemic, a proliferation problem of who are you going to call? And we listed all the institutions, APEC, ARF, you know. And what we found was even the most ardent East Asia community builders in Asia were not about to call the ARF or the ASEAN Plus 3 if there was a crisis. They were going to call the IMF, the Seventh Fleet. So we didn't ask those same questions because there was such a strong skepticism about the utility of these institutions beneath a very robust support for trying to do them. You can be very for community building as a long-range goal and be very skeptical about whether you'd really rely on it. That's what we found. So this time we asked a little different question. We said, it's not here, but we asked how is the East Asia community building going? And you know, a majority of respondents said moderately well. And then we asked what are the major obstacles? And on average across the region, it's a little hard to see, it's in your packet. On average, it was territorial issues. And history issues that ranked number one, followed by uncertainty about China. They're not wrong, because I want to show you the second slide, which was, to me, quite striking. When we asked on this question of territorial problems, if another country seized your sovereign territory, and assuming that diplomacy didn't resolve the crisis, would you support military force to retake your territory? So for Americans, you know, 88%, you know, Koreans, 86%. It was all quite high. But the one that jumps out here is Japan. 81% of Japanese experts said that they would support military force. And although we didn't mention the Senkaku Daoyudai, I think that's clearly what was in people's minds. So these territorial issues are more than we found in 2009, really in the forefront of the entire region's view of what's in the way of more cooperation. And as this poll shows, you know, there's some reason for that. I want to ask a couple people to talk about these because these disputes, of course, are all across the region. So let me turn to Chris and Bonnie and Murray.
I would just point out that I think the numbers for China really aren't that surprising. I mean, my feeling is that this reflects the not only the messaging that we're seeing coming out of the Chinese government, but also the behavior under the new Chinese leadership. And it is a good reminder that while it can be taken too far to suggest that the leadership is constantly under pressure, you know, from their own society on these issues, it's certainly a factor. I mean, elite opinion obviously is very pointed in one direction on that. Obviously, the Chinese government has done that to themselves through stoking those nationalist sentiments over the years to legitimize the system. But I think it does suggest to us that there's not going to be too many audiences in China should an accident or something occur who are saying, hey, wait a minute, let's take a pause here, or worse, if something was, you know, an effort was made to seize their territory.
Well, clearly on the history question, what the Chinese are saying here is the problem is Japan That is no surprise. There's obviously been very much a consensus in China that when it comes to history issues, that an obstacle to community building in East Asia, in their view, is because Japan has not resolved and acknowledged its role in history. On the territorial issues, I think that what the Chinese are thinking about here is that there is, in their view, a sense that the U.S. Rebalance is emboldening nations of the region to challenge China's territorial claims. I think that's what they have in their minds there. And on the second slide, I think what we see in this, of course, you know, throughout the region, not just in China, real support for using military force if their territory were attacked. I think that really what we see is whether it's in Scarborough Shoal or Second Thomas Shoal or the recent oil rig that the Chinese have positioned off the coast of the Paracels and Vietnam, that there really is just widespread support for these actions and for asserting China's claims more forcefully. So again, I think that they support what their nation is doing and are critical of what other nations are doing and what they see as U.S. support for challenging China.
Could we go back to the first slide? I'll talk a little bit about Southeast Asia. It's really interesting. You see the average is 7.9 out of on a scale of 1 to 10, the average is 7.9, concern about territorial confrontations. But the highest two, there's a tie, Indonesia and Singapore both are 8.4. They're the highest score in the whole grouping. And Thailand is 7.3, the lowest score in all of these countries. And I guess you know, the reason that you would expect that this would be the case is that Indonesia and Singapore probably are, you know, they're on the edge of the conflict or the disputes in the South China Sea. They would be most affected if there is a dispute. Its trade would be most easily disrupted. Well, on the other hand, Thailand, this survey was taken before the coup, but in the middle of the seven-month political unrest ahead of the coup, and the ties are clearly been internally focused for quite some time, but they're also the furthest away from the dispute in the South China Sea, and probably so the least affected. Then if you go to the next slide, these numbers are borne out again. Singapore and Indonesia are very high numbers for supporting military force if diplomacy fails, while Thailand, it's only 61%. And again, I think that's based on their perception. Their threats are internal mostly at this point, in their view, and so the external threats are probably minimized as a result.
Hey, Mike, can I just real quick on this? You know, I mentioned it briefly upstairs, but it really, you know, when you see it presented in this graph, when I saw the raw data, it didn't really jump out at me, but, you know, getting back to India, when you look at the countries here, on the first slide, the countries that are named specifically as will these be obstacles to community building in East Asia? So there's three that are mentioned in there that are also polled. China, and China ranks itself the lowest as a threat to community building. Japan ranks itself lowest. India ranks itself middle of the road. So it considers itself actually in the upper half as an obstacle to community building in East Asia. So I'm not sure exactly what Joel responds to say that, but they certainly have a pretty high opinion about what they plan on doing in East Asia in the future here. So
the fifth broad finding was on this question of history. And while the territorial issues were ranked very high all across the region as an obstacle to community building as a concern, history was particularly acute as an issue in Northeast Asia. On this slide, you'll see that we asked, and Victor and I spent a long time trying to figure out how we could, in one or two questions, try to capture how elites thinking about security and economics would describe the nature of these historical disputes. So we gave them four options, that it could be a source of diplomatic conflict, but not military. The green line, that it could be a source of military conflict. Yellow, it just doesn't apply, and then red, it's a political nuisance, but it's not going to be diplomatic or military. Now, India stands out here because I think for the Indian experts, its own neighborhood, especially Pakistan, drove the answer. Most countries, the leading answer was that these history disputes over how you interpret history, would be a source of diplomatic but not military conflict. Both the Japanese and Korean experts felt that. China stands out a bit, though. Chinese experts were more evenly divided, with a significant number thinking that it could be a source of military conflict. So I wanted Victor to try to unbundle this one for us.
Well, in the case of Korea, quite obviously, you know, it's all about Japan. Korea was one of the few countries, if not the only country in the survey, that rated historical obstacles. History is an obstacle to East Asian community higher than uncertainty about a rising China. And very clearly, they see lots of concerns with Japan. What is interesting, however, and I don't know if we're not at the next slide yet, but what's interesting, however, is when we look at, can we go to the next one?
Well, you can go to the next one. It's about the following challenges?
What's interesting is Korea, obviously the historical issues are about Japan, but when you look at this slide and you look at Japan and Korea side by side, if you look at almost all of these other issues, climate change, nuclear proliferation, terrorism, you go down the list, with the exception of natural disasters, Korea and Japan are almost equivalent in terms of their concerns about all of these issues. They nearly mirror each other. So I think that is really the picture of Japan-Korea relations. There's a really difficult problem with regard to history. Thankfully, both the Koreans and the Japanese don't see that as a source of military conflict, largely as a source of diplomatic conflict. But at the same time, across the broad range of issues, Japanese and Koreans share very similar views. They have very strong overlap of interest on a lot of the practical issues.
Mike, just to add on Southeast Asia, you know, history is not a major concern. You can see from the first slide, political nuisance, but not likely a cause of conflict. I think that's important because this, in response to Prime Minister Abe's speech at the Shangri-La about Japan wanting to or being willing to support the modernization and capacity building and militaries around the region in Southeast Asia, the Southeast Asians don't carry a lot of baggage from World War II on that, and then they're very, I think, very open to it. They want to be careful not to send the wrong signals and provoke China, but I think they're willing to take up that Japanese offer.
I'm glad you mentioned that. If you sort of compare this with public opinion polling about Japan in Asia, you know, in South and Southeast Asia, Japan gets well over 90% positive ratings. On the other hand, we didn't ask the exact same question that we did last time, but the overall unease about Japan is also a little higher this time. So it cuts both ways. But the Shangri-La presentation by Prime Minister Abe was well received, with one very important exception, as those who were there know. Yeah.
Can I just say one other? Yeah. The other thing worth mentioning on this chart, the chart on the screen right now, is if you look at the country that feels it doesn't apply to them the most is the United States. And that could be a literal reading of the question, in the sense that Americans don't feel that they have a lot of historical issues with the countries in the region, or it could be read as they're just not interested, one or the other. Although a literal reading of the question would lead you to believe they're responding to the notion that there aren't a lot of historical issues between the United States and the countries in the region.
Or it's just a message to everybody, we're tired of this issue.
Yeah, we don't care.
I'm going to combine the next two before I turn to the panel, but let me turn to finding six. We asked earlier, what are the obstacles to community building? This is a slightly different question. What worries you the most? Number one, across the region, economic and financial crises. I'll turn to Matt in a second on that. Number two, across the region, territory and history. Climate change, still pretty high, except in the U.S., but in certain parts of Asia, it's a concern, a security concern that's quite high. South Korea sort of stood, and Japan out from the rest of the region in their concern about North Korea. So it's a bit of a mishmash. I mean, what people are really worried about varies across the region. But the financial crises, that's pretty much common across the region, especially in developing parts of Asia, and the territorial and history disputes. Turning to finding seven, since economic crises and economic concerns were paramount in terms of challenges, I think it's important to look at how experts view the future of economic frameworks in this region. The next slide, if you could, Will. We gave them a lot of options. This isn't all of them. And asking them, how important is the success of each of these following economic frameworks to your country's future? If you look at the ranking across the region, you'll find that trans-Pacific formulas are really quite dominant. APEC, you know, a few years ago, people were writing off APEC, if you'll recall the debate. I tease Matthew Goodman because the response now that he's out of government about APEC is much higher than when he was working on it. But that could also be a sort of lag time effect of his good work. G20, quite strong support for G20. The ASEAN economic community is high because for ASEAN members it's very high. But then the next one is TPP. So, you know, at one point, there, and still there's been debate, you know, are we looking to a decoupling where we're going to have RCEP, which is listed sixth here or fifth, RCEP versus TPP, some sort of division. It doesn't come out in the expert surveys. There's a pretty heavy weighting, it seems, towards an architecture that's trans-Pacific and inclusive. Of course, we have to get TPP right and a few other things, but this, I think, is generally encouraging news for the U.S. Let me ask Matt to sort of deal with both of these, economic crisis concern and the framework that people see as most important for their country's future.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think this chart is encouraging if it really reflects broader elite opinion, including among, you know, official policymakers in the region. As Mike said, it shows that there is interest and support for these broader trans-Pacific and even global institutions. I'm particularly overjoyed to see APEC score so highly, since I usually call it the Rodney Dangerfield of U.S. foreign policy because it doesn't get enough respect. But it shows that people think it is a useful part of the architecture, at least this group as surveyed. And, you know, even China, admittedly, they're hosting APEC this year, so that may bump those scores up a little bit. But China seems to appreciate these institutions. And so I think that's all positive, and I think it does reflect more broadly that when we say that there are these schisms between people interested in one track or another track, I think we have to be careful about that, because that may not be so much about the substance of these undertakings. In other words, whether TPP or RCEP is really the better approach to regional economic integration, but more about kind of who's sitting in the big chair with the microphone and the gavel. So I think this may reflect, hopefully, the real story about the substance. On the previous slide, I think probably, particularly because of the, and Murray might want to comment on this, the scoring in the Southeast Asian countries on regional economic and financial crises, you know, I assume this is a legacy of the 1997 crisis, financial crisis in Asia, and of course the more recent crisis. And then just generally, you know, it's the economy, stupid. I think that's what people, really policymakers, are worried about as short-term challenges more broadly. So that's probably why it scores so high.
Ernie or Murray?
Thanks. I think you're absolutely right, Mike, that the 97 financial crisis still weighs heavily on people's minds. I also want to just talk a little bit about the TPP and how Southeast Asians respond to it, because I think that's the next slide, right? It's in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the average score was 75. What's interesting, Singapore, which is a member of the TPP, scored it very high at 82. Thailand, which is not a member and pre-coup government, had the administration had looked at trying to join TPP in the second tranche. In Indonesia, however, is only at 43%. Indonesia, if you follow it, has been introducing some fairly nationalistic protectionist measures over the last couple of years. They think their time has come. They need to keep what's in Indonesia for the Indonesians, and so they rank it, the TPP, very low. However, in the regional comprehensive partnership, what's interesting, the score is almost the same in the regional average, but Indonesia, which only gave 43% rating to the TPP, gives the RCEP 74%, and Thailand is roughly in the same place it was on the TPP at 75%, and Singapore also at 83%, which is roughly the same. So there's a outside of Indonesia, there is a broad consensus that the economic architecture, the trade architecture that's being hammered out, is worthy of support.
I mean, the point here, Mike, is that I just want to make this again, because I think we sort of missed this in our trade or economic policy. Asia doesn't see an integrated Asian and a future of Asian economic integration that excludes China. It's not going to happen, and I think we have to get our heads around that. And I know China is open or are eligible and invited to join the TPP if they want to. But I think we really have to reconceptualize, what do we do next beyond the TPP to have a comprehensive strategy. The other thing that is, I think, just screams out from this chart is that for a lot of Asia, economics is the foundation of security. And so these things are very tightly linked in the minds of our partners in the region.
I would just add quickly that if you look at Taiwan, it wants to be in everything it can. Maybe this is the point you're about to make, Bonnie. Obviously, it can't be in the ASEAN economic community, but Taiwan wants in.
Right. I was just going to make the point that Taiwan clearly wants to be included in something. It is excluded from all of these multilateral organizations, but it's really notable that 100% support TPP, support RCEP. Taiwan just clearly wants to be included.
Two more, if you'll bear with me. Finding Eight, we've found robust support for regional, in the region, for democratic values, except in the U.S., where the support declined considerably since our last survey. We asked last time for our respondents to rank the priorities for creation of an East Asia community over the course of 10 years. Next slide, Will. This is the current one. But it was the same questions, and not surprisingly, the top priorities were establishing a framework for trade and regional economic integration, and then confidence building, preventing conflict. Last time, 2009, it jumped out at us that the next priorities were all about good governance, human rights, free and fair elections, rule of law. And so one of the headlines for us last time, it really was quite striking, was how much in Asia, with the exception of China, but even in China, about half the respondents were supportive. And of course, you have to allow for interpretation of what these terms mean in each country. But there was quite robust support for an East Asian norm or set of norms around these issues, with the important caveat that China, Indonesia, India, non-aligned, post-colonial, and other states said non-interference in internal affairs is also important. This time, the broad support went up a bit, but next slide, Will. But among Americans, it dropped among the American experts. I've sort of pondered what this means. Seems to me that with the question of tactics on how you improve good governance, democracy, and women's empowerment aside, and that's a big question, this is a region that generally is quite different from the Middle East. And that this ought to be part of the American playbook. And yet, American experts have lost a little of their shine about these things. It could be because of our own experience as Americans with the Middle East, which has been pretty darn disappointing over the last decade. It could be that it's, as the Washington Post suggested in an article today, it just isn't part of the narrative from the president as much as in the past. Could be a post-Iraq hangover. Who knows? It does strike me as a something of a lost opportunity for Americans to think about how this region, unlike say the Middle East, which we think about a lot, generally has a good story on democracy, good governance, and over half of the respondents everywhere supported, including these in East Asia community building in our regional dialogue. I'm going to then, if I And Ernie, you wanted to say something on this?
I would just say, you know, there's been some, I think, sort of very superficial analysis of late, you know, suggesting that Asia's going backwards on democratic values and human rights. And you know, they're pointing at things like the coup in Thailand. And, you know, there are things to point at that would suggest a challenge to that. But I see something completely different, particularly in Southeast Asia. What I see is an assertion of a growing and empowered and connected middle class that really is pushing the envelope, pushing for the development of institutions, and they are asking for more participation, better governance. And so I see the, you know, sort of an uptick on the democracy, human rights, governance interest there. Will it be interesting to see how, you know, some of the current political situations work out. But I suspect, for instance, in a place like Thailand, that both poles, you know, there's very partisan or polar approach in Thailand right now. I suspect what we'll see, I don't know over what period of time, you know, between 2 and 10 years, the rise of a moderate middle. And I think we're going to see that. We see that happen in Indonesia. And I wonder, you know, whether that's not going to be a trend that impacts places like China in the future. So I think this is something, I find it a very interesting finding and one that we should really think about strategically.
Over half of the American respondents said these were important issues, but on women's empowerment and human rights, Americans were last, below China. and Koreans were pretty low on women's empowerment. Yeah. On other democratic norms, they were quite high. So it's you know, it's thought-provoking. I'm still trying to make sense of it, but something especially for Americans to ponder. Last but not least, we asked about Taiwan. You can just put the slide up and I'll let Bonnie explain this one.
If Taiwan were reunified with China through coercive means, what would be the impact on your country's interests? Clearly, we did not simply ask the question if it were peacefully unified. We might have gotten very different questions. Very different answers. But this to me is very significant. 99% in the U.S., 98% in Japan concerned a negative impact on our country's interests, even more than in Taiwan, which is 89%, and significantly high level of concern in Korea, in India, and in Singapore. Notably, even in China, 43%. Think that it would have a negative impact, as opposed to 40 that would think that there would be a positive impact. Now, to me, this reflects, at least among the strategic elites in China, that they need to pursue peaceful development strategy to win over the hearts and minds in Taiwan, that using coercive measures would probably redound negatively to Chinese interests. Now, we don't have, of course, any data for comparison because we didn't ask this in 2009, but my guess is that these response rates for very negative impact are higher than they would have been in the past. And I think that there was a time that maybe some countries in the region might have seen Chinese coercion against Taiwan as a special case. That would not necessarily mean that China might use force or coercive measures against, for example, Philippines, Vietnam, other countries in Southeast Asia. But I think that that view has really changed. I think that's one of the things we are seeing in this slide, that there's greater concern that if the mainland does use coercive measures against Taiwan, that this is going to be even more of a signal and evidence of China's willingness to use coercion against some of its other neighbors.
Very quickly on this, I would add to Bonnie's already excellent analysis that I think, to me, what was striking about this was it was also saying a lot about how everyone in the region valued U.S. credibility, because if you read the question the way it's written, it's presuming essentially that there's a coercive reunification in which the United States either became militarily involved and failed or did not stop. And for that reason, it is also a prism through which issues of U.S. credibility are refracted.
So there's more actually in the packet and on our website. Again, we listed these 9 findings as things that in our discussions we thought stood out. But the main advantage of this kind of survey we find is makes you think comparatively across countries, it makes you think about regional dynamics, makes you think about expectations. Again, we want to thank Ernie Pacopoulos from Opinion Dynamics and MacArthur for helping us pay for this, and all my colleagues and their research fellows and staff. And let me now turn it over to you for questions, comments, and we can always bring back up a slide if you'd like. Captain Nelson.
Thanks very much. Chris Nelson, Nelson Report. Great discussion. I have to give a paper on all this in Berlin in about 2 weeks, so I'm going to cheerfully plagiarize a hell of a lot of what you were talking about. A point that you made that really strikes home is the difference between management and solution or solving. You know, we're all have a tendency to be liberal internationalists, small l. And, you know, liberals kind of always believe that we can really fix this. We can fix whatever it is. That's what we do. And maybe not some of these things, especially in history, especially in territory, without taking sides. So this is my question. In your poll, did you get a sense that once you get outside of China, that even though the primacy of the China economic relationship is what it is, that Asians want to see a more robust American military or strategic response to China's behavior? And if so, what are they talking about? Does it bother them they don't see the Seventh Fleet steaming through the Scarborough Shoals? You know, is that the kind of lesson they think they're drawing from, quotes, our failure, quotes, in Syria and Ukraine, even though they're, you know, they're so different, you don't see how they do it. But that keeps coming up in the commentary. Do Asians seem to want to see a more robust American strategic/military response to the Chinese activities? Thank you.
Let me do a first quick stab at this. We didn't ask that question specifically. Let me also add, we didn't include, because we didn't have enough money, Philippines, Vietnam, Mongolia, where we would have gotten even more reinforcing of this. We want more of the American presence. We're worried. On the other hand, we didn't include Russia, which frankly right now would trend in the other direction, I think it's safe to say. In terms of the specific military role, I can tell you it varies from country to country. I mean, in Northeast Asia, Japan and Korea want us to be very visible, very present vis-a-vis North Korea. Japanese want us to be very visible and present vis-a-vis China. South Koreans, not quite as much. So it's going to vary from country to country. We won't have time to go through all of it. But the bottom line that comes out pretty clearly in this is that everybody wants more of us economically and in security. And although the Chinese respondents don't want more of us in security, they clearly want more of us economically, as you saw in the question about economic partnership. Anybody, can't do everybody, but.
Well, I'd just say, you know, I mean, we did have the question, is the rebalance too confrontational to China? And that doesn't necessarily mean strategic military, but when I read the question, I think more of that than economic issues. And, you know, three countries in particular, India, Japan, and the United States, all viewed, they sort of voted that no, indeed, it was not too confrontational towards China, which you could read as saying, they wish it were more so. And I think, you know, with India, like we look at the issues of confrontation that China has had on its borders to the east and the ocean. But actually, you know, last year there was this issue in India, northern India, where Chinese troops had crossed the border and camped out for a couple of weeks. And, you know, India didn't have very many tools to deal with that. And we weren't really in a position that I know of for the United States to intervene there. So, you know, issues like that, you know, I think kind of India may actually want a little bit of a ratchet up in confrontation. So they answered a strong no, we don't think the rebalance is too confrontational. So if you read it in the opposite, they might appreciate it.
And for Southeast Asia, Chris, I think you get sort of the opposite view that actually, you know, U.S. economic engagement, a political foundation for American engagement being built in the United States, these are what they want to see to repel or moderate a China, what they see as an increasingly aggressive Chinese approach to their sovereignty and the territorial disputes. So they don't, the Southeast Asians don't want to see, you know, sort of guns and boots, but they, China is pushing them in some places like the Philippines to be more open to that. But I keep saying, economics is the foundation of security for the Southeast Asians. It's also a good reason why Southeast Asia, that ASEAN core, is a very, it's a really intuitive core or fulcrum for regional regional strategy, security strategy. It doesn't replace alliances, but it actually is a place where you can meet and shape how the Chinese might behave over time.
Thanks. I'm going to try to be yes, Michael.
I want to raise two issues. One is building on what Mr. Bauer said. It seems that we should really think in terms of the sort of liberal internationalist approach in a rather different way, in the sense that the emphasis in that approach is on obviously trade and economics and so on, and they see that values grow out of that. But I think what the lesson is from what I've been hearing and what I've felt for a long time is that for, I would say, all the Asian governments, the question of economics is central to the security of their governments internally. And it came out, I think, very much in Sino-Japanese relations. Both sides recognized that their economic interdependence acted as a kind of restraint as to how far they would go. And so in that sense, we have to think of economic relationships and interdependence much more in terms of the significance it plays in domestic politics. It's not just a question of values and so on. The second point I'd like to raise, it seems to me that one of the things that comes out, perhaps not fully, is that the Chinese experts seem to be a little bit behind their government. For example, if you think of the recent major statements of Xi Jinping about foreign policy, it's very much Asia-centered, with China in the middle, as it were. And there's a very clear attempt to exclude the United States from the various frameworks he's thinking about. But it seems from what your surveys suggest is that the Chinese experts still want to hold on to the relationship with the United States in a very significant and comprehensive way.
Those are excellent points. Thank you, Michael. I think you're right about the primacy of economics to security, particularly for developing countries, but across the region. It was striking that over 40% of Chinese experts thought historical issues could lead to military conflict. So there's an anxiety about this that's quite high. But your point, I think, is right. Let me ask Chris and maybe Bonnie if they want on this question of whether the Chinese respondents are a bit behind the elite. One thing we couldn't objectively measure, we can venture some opinions about, is how well these reflect government positions. And it may be in China less so than in the US, Australia, Japan, or Korea.
I think there's, just based on my recent trips there is some sense that they're not fully on board with the new approach that the administration has been taking. They see it as dangerous, possibly certainly counterproductive, possibly dangerous, and something that is not necessarily in China's long-term strategic interest. I also think that it does reflect the point I made earlier, though, that because they're not sure yet how to conduct themselves as a maturing international global power, there's a sort of clinging for what they know, which is the U.S. dominance. I really think that, and that comes out especially strongly among America hands inside China. So I think there might be a little bit of respondent bias in those numbers, but that's just my own thought.
I should add, we tried very carefully when we made this list to not just ask the America hands. We tried to get a broader representation. But there is an ambivalence among the Chinese experts that comes out in this about Chinese power.
And just one other point before Bonnie jumps in. I coming back to the economics piece, it is about economics is security and economics is also stability. I mean, I think one of the key points coming out of the U.S.-China numbers in this is that it is indeed another indicator of how the economic relationship plays such an important role as a stabilizer and shock absorber in the bilateral relationship.
I was just at the Shangri-La dialogue in Singapore, and many of the officials and experts there cautioned that Xi Jinping's proposal of Asia for Asians is not necessarily aimed at excluding the United States. And there seems to be an effort to try and balance this view. Perhaps China just doesn't want to be seen as pushing out the United States or taking on a bigger role prematurely. But I think that they do understand that the rest of the region certainly doesn't want to see the U.S. Pushed out. So maybe we should stay tuned for some clarification on that. And just to add one point, again, from some of my discussions at the Shangri-La Dialogue in response to Chris Nelson's question, I think that there are great differences, perhaps, among the Southeast Asian nations about U.S. military presence. But I would draw a distinction between a strong desire for quiet, persistent presence, as compared to what some countries are worried about, a more confrontational presence, because they really don't want to see real confrontation and friction between the U.S. and China. But continued U.S. presence, particularly freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea, I think receive very warm support.
Can you have a microphone? Thanks.
Gil Rosman. Victor, you talked about the schizophrenia in Korea. I wonder if you look at the overall results of Japan and Korea on these nine questions and sub-questions, whether you see Japan and Korea drifting further apart, as in their views of CJK, or you see some signs that because they have so much in common, they can overcome the aspects of difference.
I think on, and my colleagues can may have a better recollection, when I think about the pair in terms of their responses to the questions, the biggest gap was on one of the slides we put up, which was, who do you see as your important economic partner in the future? That was where the biggest gap was, where Koreans were, 86% China, and Japan is, 70-something percent U.S. But aside from that, on most of the other questions in terms of how they saw the key issues for their national security and how they saw the economic institutions and the regional institutions, there's a lot of symmetry between the respondents in Korea and Japan. And then, of course, it's the history issue in which we see the biggest gulf. And I think that while I don't want to say that that's what I expected to see, because then it sounds like our surveys weren't that helpful, what it did do was it validated for me my own assumptions, which were that, yes, there are these very difficult history issues, but from sort of a realpolitik level, there is such a strong overlap between these two countries. For policymakers, the question is, can you still continue to forge pragmatic cooperation in spite of these history issues, which I don't think anybody believes are going to go away. They're not going to go away. You just try to cope. You try to get through them each time they come up. So in that sense, I thought the findings of the survey really provided some good empirical evidence for some of the assumptions that I held as a researcher of these relationships. So yeah.
Good. Thanks. Yes, sir. Right in the front.
Yes, thank you for your research, and as I am interested in the Triton order and power in Asia, I would be interested in your view, one of the panelists, about the Chinese claim U-shape in the whole South China Sea and East Sea, as a Vietnam call. With that, and as opposed to the books published by Chinese government by 2019-12, that the border of China is only to the Hainan Island. So that one is the most far south of China. So 100 years after, they claim the sea territory for the whole part of that region. And another question is that we all recognize the rising power of China, and it is a legitimate desire for China to be a big power as a major nation in Asia. But how would the people in Asia think, or particularly the Chinese people, think about the leadership statement about the rising a power in China in a peaceful way, as opposed to their actions over the last few years with Japan, with the Philippines, and now with Vietnam. Thank you.
So Nick, remind me, we got the survey results.
Can you just identify himself?
Sorry, could you identify yourself, sir? I'm sorry, would you tell us who you are?
And who you're with.
Yes, my name is Hai Ching, and I am with the private consulting firm HTKH International.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So
Thank
Nick, remind me, but we had about a 2-3 week period to do the surveys. We didn't want too much time, because then you'd have people responding to different events. But all the results were in before this Chinese
Oil rig
went out. So I suspect, based on the atmosphere in Shangri-La and other things, we might have had some even more pronounced responses to China's power and uncertainty. But I don't know if, did you do this on a purpose? I don't know if Chris or Ernie or Marie want to weigh in on the specific issue. Chris, your mic's on. Did you want to?
No.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'm Ben Self. I'm adjunct fellow here and at GW. I have a question about figure 10 for Mike and for Rick. I just quickly tried to figure out an average level of threat perception in each country. So rather than average across on the issue versions, if you kind of figured an average up and down vertically to see how nervous these countries are about their security. Clearly, Australia and the United States stand out as very unconcerned. They're basically all green. India stands out as the most threatened. And so, Rick, I'm curious why India has such a high level of threat. It's averaging over 7 in terms of how serious these issues are. But Mike, I wanted to ask you, Japan is under average, 6.1, 6.2. below the overall average slightly. Given recently Japanese have become much more concerned about their security environment, and you've written eloquently about this, what would you say explains this sort of lower level than average sense of threat perception by the Japanese compared with their neighbors in the region, not necessarily with the US or Australia?
I have to think about that, so you can go first, Rick.
Yeah. Well, I think, luckily it breaks it down, so it's the answers, clearly terrorism. I mean, there's no question about what the single biggest threat that they've got from an externality. It happens relatively frequently at a low level, and occasionally you've got a Mumbai or a parliament attack. So that one. On climate change, that one's a little tricky, right? I mean, because you think India, many in India say that, America polluted heavily during its phase of economic growth. We're entering that phase right now. We should be given a little bit of leeway. But I think with climate change, what they may be specifically referring to is the fact that about 50% of India's working population is still in basic agriculture. And a good monsoon, a bad monsoon, things like that, is the single biggest impact on the majority of workers' lives. And so when you think about what impact that would then have on domestic politics, when do things really destabilize if suddenly, 50% of the people just don't know if they're going to be able to grow an ear of corn the next year? Human security needs, food, water security is, I think, relatively obvious, lack of natural resources. So nothing, I think, that other than the climate change. That might be one where, I think people would be a little bit surprised that they weigh that so heavily, but I think it probably, huh?
The tsunami,
yeah. I mean, they've got real issues that pop up.
I think Matt was, if I understood his gesticulating just now. I think one reason Japan is low is if you look at the bottom, internal ethnic conflict is nowhere on the map. So, that Ainu threat from Hokkaido, not a major concern. I don't know about Gaijin scholars living in Tokyo. That's another problem. So, that probably brings Japan down a bit. But when it comes to the territorial disputes, Japan's right up there with Korea, China, and the others. Japan's very low on climate change. Actually, which is interesting for a country that was really, after all the Kyoto protocols were in Kyoto, quite low. I think that accurately reflects the mood in Japan right now, post 3/11, and frankly out of sync with where Washington is when it comes to things like coal and other things. Matt, did I get your gesture right?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for putting together this this survey. I just
sorry. Would you? I know who you are, but would you mind identifying yourself?
Sure,
I should have
sure.
asked others.
My name is Xue Yuan Xu. I work in the Chinese Embassy. Thank you for putting this together this survey. I find many findings are very interesting. Before I raise a question, I just want to add two facts on a comment made by the so-called China-centered speech by President Xi Jinping. One is fact is China was the first nation that made the public statement that China welcomed the United States to participate EAS. The second fact is that the platform where President Xi Jinping made that speech considered by some that he means, meant China-centered, it was not a group that is exclusive. Actually, many countries, including the United States, at least, is one of the observers. And my question is, I find the very, if you look at figure 3 and figure 7 of this survey, you will find in figure 3 that most of the countries in Asia consider China will be their most important economic partner 10 years from now. And in figure 7, that most of the countries in Asia welcomes the policy of rebalance policy of the United States, but they think there is something insufficient resource and implementation. I don't know whether this survey also covers the details of what are insufficient there by the rebalance policy, or what do you think, what is insufficient there? Thank you.
Thank you. And I would note that I think with the exception of the question, what future order do you prefer, where only about 10% of the Chinese respondents said they wanted a U.S.-led order, with the exception of that, there's clear ambivalence about American leadership in the regional order. With the exception of that, you get a strong sense that Chinese experts are welcome, if I can say it, cohabitation in Asia with the United States. It doesn't come out in our results that there's anything like a consensus or even a strong minority view that China somehow has to push the U.S. out of Asia. That does come through. Chris, do you want to weigh on this?
Well, I think we've been the theme that's been running through all of our comments today is what's missing from the rebalance, if you will, right? And I think it's the trade stuff that Ernie referred to earlier. It's the sort of questioning about, you know, now that we have the policy, what's the next step? You know, we've talked a lot, I think, among us on the panel about next steps in these various areas. And so I think that's reflective. I also think that it's reflective of the fact that, as you were saying earlier, Mike, there's just more demand across the board for the U.S. presence.
If you look at the Councilor Shui pointed out figure 7, which is this box, and you'll find that the blue dots in the lower right, the countries that expressed where experts expressed the most concern, are all TPP partners, U.S. allies, or countries that in the survey expressed the most concern about China's rise. So I think that begins to answer the question about sufficiency of resources. Thailand is a complete anomaly in every one of these questions. We only have about 1 minute left, but I wonder if we could conclude maybe by putting the spotlight on Ernie and Marie to explain. This, by the way, was true last time, too. The Thai responses were really out of step with the rest of the region. They're just a unique, independent-minded people, I suppose, but very different answers to these questions than other U.S. allies or
Mike,
even other Asian countries.
I think you've answered the question. I think a lot of this has to do with Thailand's own feeling of sort of disappointment in what they assumed was a very strong and vibrant U.S. relationship. The Thais really don't forget when you're inconsistent with them. And I hate to generalize like that, but it's true. They really do carry around a very strong feelings as a country over the U.S. response to the financial crisis, which they felt was very antiseptic. And then you can't win after that because Thailand began to polarize. And our response to the coup in 2006 really alienated at least half the Thais, okay? You know, so, and I think that's a problem. The other problem is that they are, some, I think Murray explained this earlier, these guys are really focused on themselves right now. And it's existential, you know, once in a 100-year sort of reordering of power that's underway in Thailand, and that's what they're focused on. So I'm not surprised Thailand had some anomalous responses. I think if we do this survey and, you know, after things settle, which I can't tell you what the X is, that Thailand will be closer to a blueberry than whatever that yellow thing is up there right now.
So let me thank my colleagues. It's been great, great fun drawing on everyone's expertise in designing and interpreting this. Thank you for your comments. We would certainly welcome written comments if you want to send them in. We may post some of it on our, if you're interested, on our blog site, Cogit Asia. But thank you all very much for coming today.